Hello and welcome to the True Blue LA podcast. Jacob Birch, Eric Steven, here to talk about Dodgers baseball.
Yay! Jacob, we are officially talking about a playoff team.
Playoffs?
I don't know if that's surprising to you, but yeah, the Dodgers actually qualified, so they didn't, after that bad week, they didn't lose out and lose out on the playoffs.
An interesting week. Two weeks ago, we had an extremely good week. Dodgers had one loss, but just looked extremely on fire. Had kind of a sour week last week, a lot of frustrating things to talk about. And mostly a good week, I think, between the last time we recorded with some downbeat notes. So a little kind of mixed together. And we're going to cover all of that with the normal Dodgers Rewind and questions from Craig with maybe some more notes. All of that after this. We're recording this on Friday evening, and the Dodgers are currently playing. Is this the first time we've recorded and been at risk for disseminating a game?
I want to say we did it one other time, but I don't remember when. I suppose I could look back at the record dates.
And if we did, it might have been like at the very end or beginning. This is just right in the middle. It's a middle inning. I don't want to get too close, but So the Dodgers and Coors are in Coors after a series at Petco Park. That was a fun series.
Yeah, it was like a. I was like, it was exciting, right? Like the Dodgers and Padres. You could make an argument for the Braves, I suppose, but I think the Dodgers and Padres are basically like the two best teams in the National League, or at least have played like it this year. And like that was a fun series, like just like the excitement around it. However, it was like weird because, for one, like. The Dodgers and Padres are almost never good at the same time. The Padres, like, their history isn't as good as the Dodgers, obviously. But, like, when they are good, the Dodgers were kind of bad. And, like, I think I looked it up. In their history, which Padres began in 1969, in September, both teams were within five games of first place when the Dodgers and Padres played, like, five times. Or this was, like, the fifth time. So, like, it barely ever happens, right? But at the same time, this is the weirdest like playoff year ever. Mm-hmm. And because of the structure of the playoffs, the Dodgers and Padres are kind of locked in like the same path right now, like almost no matter what happened, like one of them is going to be the one seed. The other one's going to be the four seed as the second place finisher with the best record. The Padres, as we speak, have the second best record in the National League right now. And the way we'll get to the playoff format in a second, but like there's very, very little advantage to being one or the other, given how it plays out. I think more than anything, and I think this showed in a couple ways, it was like a series for pride in a way. Like, you know, the Dodgers, they obviously want to win the division, but even they were saying like, Dave Roberts said, there's no real incentive. The way the system is set up, not that they're not trying, but it's like it's just weird. We'll get into the playoff format in a little bit, but so the one of the reasons why it's they're kind of the same is that after the three division leaders at the moment, the Braves and the Cubs, plus the Dodgers and then the Padres, like the rest of the National League is crap. Like it's there's just like a morass of mediocrity. Like after the fourth seed. And so there's teams fighting for like the fifth through the eighth seed. And then if you go down, basically the difference between fifth and 12th is almost negligible right now. So like the Dodgers as the one seed would play the eighth seed in the first round. The Padres would play the five seed, but there's not a lot of difference between the five and the eight right now. So it's kind of like the same series. That's why it's a little weird. However, right away you could tell the series mattered because the first game was a really fun like pitcher's duel. Nelson Lamet was great.
It was the great front half of a doubleheader almost. Like at the very end of it.
Yeah, like imagine if it was a 7-inning game. It was also a script a Clayton Kershaw playoff game. You know, like the game was 1-1 into the 7th, and it was It was 1-0 Dodgers for a while until Trent Grisham tied the game with a really majestic home run, really, and like immediately like turned and like started yelling stuff at his own dugout. They were celebrating, which is great, whatever, it's fine. But like the Dodgers took offense to that. Like Dave Roberts yelled from the dugout, "Run!" like to him, then the other Dodgers started yapping at him, and then Grisham like yelled back, and I think he flipped off the Dodgers dugout. I'm not Dave Roberts mentioned that on the Joe Davis and Oral Hershiser podcast. So like there were words back and forth. It didn't escalate to the point of like the Fernando Tatis like swinging 3-0 move in Texas earlier this year, where like it got to the point where everyone's like, "Oh, you're breaking the unwritten rules." Dave Roberts did have a quote post game that I kind of bristled at, because he was like, you know, someone with the stature of Kershaw, he needs more respect. Like, whatever. Like,
yeah,
that was a little much. Like, it's always like, it's like annoying that baseball is so like committed to like tamp down the fun, right? However, that said, like, I completely enjoy, in fact, the point that where both teams are like jawing at each other and like there's actual like rivalry on the field, and like it didn't like devolve into like people throwing at people, right? So like that's like the best of both worlds. They just settled it on the field. It was like a fun like sort of rivalry type moment, and that was fun. But also, Roberts was really just sticking up for Kershaw, I think, in that regard. And like he wasn't saying like, you know, play the game the right way. He kind of did, but it was like tame, I think, relatively. That said, you know, there was nothing came of it, so that's like the best part of all of this. But then you saw the Dodgers like the next 2 days, the Padres ended up rallying late and won that game. Oh, the reason it was a Kershaw scripted playoff game is because he left with two runners on in the seventh. It was like, I think he had his most swing and misses in 3 years, and that game was like 21, and like 18 were on the slider. He was looking great. He leaves with two runners on in the seventh, 1-1 game. Pedro Baez comes in, lets both inherited runners score. You know, pretty much that's like your classic October nightmare scenario that we've seen like in numerous years in the past. But anyway, the Padres won that game. But the next couple games, the Dodgers were like, they were like hooting and hollering from the dugout. You could hear it because there's nobody in the stands. You could hear it on the broadcast. Like anytime they did something good, and they actually did a lot well in those last two games. The offense picked it up a little bit, but also like Tony Gonsolin was great, and then Dustin May was not hurt, which was, we were sort of worried about that last week because he got hit in the foot. But he made his outing. They did an opener that was kind of weird. We'll get to that in a little bit. But it was a fun series. And the way it's set up, so the Dodgers left San Diego, or I guess San Diego was off Thursday. The Dodgers won their opener in Colorado, so they enter today with a 4-game lead with 9 to play. So the division is theirs for the taking, right? The magic number, as we're recording this, is 5. By the time this comes out, it could be even lower. It's looking like they're going to win the National League West. So they're going to probably be the 1 seed, and the Padres are going to probably be the 4 seed. And if they both win in the wild card round, they'll play in an NLDS, which is great. Like, that would be really fun.
Now, importantly, the Dodgers will have home field advantage in Texas.
That's right. So their division series would be in Arlington. Basically, if the Dodgers are the
one,
I'm
really glad it's not in Houston.
Yeah. So the other NLDS, the 3-6 versus 2-7 winner NLDS, that's in Houston. But for the Dodgers, if they're the 1 seed, all of their remaining playoffs are in Arlington. If they keep winning. So, because the NLCS is there, the World Series is there, and then their NLDS would be there. So get used to that coconut husk, like weird thing on every like ground ball. But yeah, but there's a couple other weird things about that series, right? So I'll just get to it now, I guess. So Dustin May started the last game of the series, or he didn't start. He pitched, they did an opener, right? Like, they were a little worried about his foot. They didn't know exactly how long he was going to go. He ended up going 5 1/3. Basically,
what I love about this is, so that happened, right? They led with Brusdar, And yep. then they got May in. I'm like, oh, this is a great way to get around the stupid win rule. And then they still didn't give him the win.
Yeah. And it was really because it's not like default, but it kind of is. The Dodgers took the lead with the second pitcher in the game. Like, Kolarik came in and then the second. So, like, in a normal circumstance, had, like, they been leading when Kolarik came in, I think May would have got the win. There's no real logic to it. But, like, so the point is, so, like, the Dodgers saw fit in their biggest series of the year to experiment a little in the last game. The Padres, they maneuvered. They had two games delayed by COVID over the weekend. So they had a chance to sort of shuffle their rotation, and they did so where the Dodgers didn't face Clevinger. The Dodgers have never faced Clevinger. And that was a little gamesmanship, I think, to get them to not see him before a potential division series matchup. So there's a little gamesmanship there, but that led to a situation where they also moved Chris Paddock, who was dealing with an ankle thing, to Friday. So the Padres went with a bullpen game on Wednesday in their biggest series of the year. So, like, it mattered, but it kind of didn't, you know, like it mattered sort of, right? Like that's why it was weird. So while we're talking about this, how it's like, if they meet again, it'll be in Arlington. The playoff schedule was released this week. It's kind of, you know, we've sort of talked about it before, but the wild card series is best of three. It's at everyone's home park. So the Dodgers will be at Dodger Stadium. And it starts Wednesday, the 30th, which is the AL starts on Tuesday, the 29th, which means there's, excuse me, 2 days or one. There's one guaranteed day of 8 games of baseball, which is that is 8 games of. Well, you can't watch all of them like by themselves. So like it's the closest thing baseball will ever come to the NCAA tournament. With all the like those important games on at the same time. And then if depending on how many AL series go to third game, you could have a second day of 8 games. So it's a little weird. But yeah, the American League is coming to Dodger Stadium and Petco. Dodger Stadium will only host a division series. Petco gets the a division series and the NLCS or ALCS, excuse me. and we talked about the Dodgers and NL teams going to Texas. The weird part about the schedule is there's no off days in series. So you're basically in a situation where it's the closest thing playoff baseball has ever been to regular season baseball in like MLB history, really. There's a few days off in between the wild card round and the division series. So like it does, like I think the game one starter, whether it's Kershaw or Buehler, could start game one of the division series on, I believe, 5 days rest. So it allows for that, right? So you're not like completely like screwed over based on that. But it's just potentially five games in 5 days, and the championship series and championship series is 7 games in 7 days, which that is going to be nuts. And then the World Series goes back to like the normal off days, 2-3-2, which is, I mean, I get it. I think that's for more capitalizing on TV probably there, but it's going to be weird. But I think the Dodgers, who are, you know, have one of the deepest like pitching staffs, you would think that would be a place where one of their advantages lie. So like in game like 3 or 4, of the division series, not only are you like you have a tired bullpen, but your starter is not as, you might not be as good. Whereas the Dodgers can keep trotting out like, you know, 5 pretty good starters like the whole series. So it's going to be exciting and weird, but just different than kind of anything we've ever seen.
Mentioned the experimenting in that last game. Is this experimenting going to carry over into the playoffs? Like the Dodgers pitching staff sort of took some like minor hits, I guess, like both starters and relievers over the last 2 weeks. And it's kind of in an odd spot.
Yeah. So I guess they're not going to, I guess, you know, they're not going to like decide on the rotation. They've basically like the only thing that would stop them from going Kershaw Buehler or Buehler Kershaw in games one and two is Buehler's blister at this point. And like he's going to only make one regular season start before the playoffs at most. Right. He's starting, I think, this weekend at some point at USC. He's not on the road trip with them. Just doing a sim game, I think, going like six innings. And then he's going to start one of the games in the last week of the year. My guess is they'll go Kershaw one and Buehler two. But that's just a guess at this point. And then after that, it's like, I don't know. They said they're not going to decide. But then it also gets to the point, like, I think part of that where they did an opener for May, you could see them doing that in the playoffs with any of the other three guys because they've had short leashes for them, like, all year. So I don't know who – like, if I had to pick right now, like, if you just asked me to pick who should start game three, I would – in like the wild card round, because it's only three games, I would go Gonsolin at this point. I think he's been the best of the three. The argument you could make for Dustin May, because he's been close, is that he is the least likely to thrive in like a shorter relief role, just given what he did. He would be okay, but like I think I would go with Gonsolin as a starter for game three.
He's looked really good. You mentioned that this guy's not really getting a long leash. They gave him that long leash. Now, granted, that was with them knowing the bullpen game was coming. So
right. Well, and also we're right now watching a game. The Dodgers are doing a bullpen game tonight too. So like, it's a lot of bullpen games. Bullpen game at Coors is certainly an idea. But it's weird. But and then also the other thing is like. You might even see like an opener with Julio Urias because he's allowed 10 runs in the first inning. And like it. So Robert's big thing is I went and looked like the velocity wasn't that off last night, but he's mentioned that where sometimes Julio will come in and throw like 90, 91 in the first inning. Then he gets into his stuff and he's like 93, 94 or maybe higher. He sort of mentioned that with Kenley too at times. And like the challenge is like getting him to come out just firing right away. And I think that's the issue. I don't know if you solve that. Do you have Urias like throw like an inning in the bullpen before he comes into the game just to sort of get that adrenaline pumping? And then you have a reliever start the game for an inning. I don't know, but it wouldn't put it past them to try that in the playoffs. But it'll be weird because he had a start last night, like first five hitters, three hits, two runs. And then after that, like, I think he retired like 13 straight. And the only one that reached, for him after that was someone on an error. So he was really good. And like, he's been mostly really good. But it's just like getting into the rhythm of the game. Like, see, he's only allowed like, so there's 10 first inning runs, but then after that, 9 runs in 39 innings. So like, it's weird. So they could like mix and match stuff. Roberts did mention liking like the opener, about, I don't know, like just because there's times where you can do matchups. So like, I don't, depending on the lineup, let's say it's Urias, right? But then a team has like, is stacked at the top of their lineup with like three or four, maybe three right-handers out of the first four. Maybe you start like a right-hander in the first inning and then bring Urias in right after that. And then it solves sort of two issues there. I don't know. That's, I think they're open to that. I don't know what's going to happen. But then, so you talked about they're doing the bullpen game. So they got Joe Kelly back. He pitched last night after serving a suspension. Pedro Baez is back. He's been, like, okay. Like, he did allow those inherited runs. Hasn't been the best. But, like, as long as he's healthy, he's going to play, like, an important role, pitch it in important innings like he sort of usually does. The one big blow though was Caleb Ferguson, Tuesday night, in San Diego, he struck out, his first hitter, three pitches, but on the third pitch sort of grimaced, felt something in his elbow. Within a few days it was reported that, or he found out via MRI, torn UCL. He's going to have Tommy John surgery again. He had it 6 years ago, as a senior in high school, right before the Dodgers drafted him. So, like, that's brutal. And like, cause he was, I know we talked, he allowed home runs in like three straight games recently, but even with that, he was one of their like best and most trusted relievers, like strikeout rate. Great. Doesn't really walk anybody. It was really effective against both sides. And it's just a bummer. Cause he's, I mean, you have to think he's going to miss like this year and next year. So like, that's, it just sucks, you know?
Now, before we get to trivia, you have one more note for us.
Yeah, so we talked about like them sort of experimenting and possibly doing stuff in the playoffs. So a couple, about a week and a half ago, the Dodgers started Austin Barnes at catcher, and they had Will Smith DH that game. And, you know, managers are usually like, oh, man, we can't use that second catcher because what if we lose him? And then we don't have any catchers. You know, like it's just, they're always scared of that. I asked Dave Roberts about that this week. He's – the way Will Smith is hitting – he's like one of the best hitters on the team. And he's going to DH tomorrow. We're recording this on Friday. He's going to DH Saturday. Barnes is catching Kershaw again, and he's probably going to catch Kershaw like every playoff start. And there's a decent chance that Smith is going to DH when Barnes catches. Maybe not every game, but like some games. And that's good.
I seem to recall this coming up.
Yeah, and I think last week,
and somebody said Will Smith might give me this, Eric.
You, I will give you credit for that. I was just saying my stance on that was I think also that Will Smith will just play more, like a catcher. But there's also the thing of like not burning him out, you know,
sure,
which is the normal thing. But also, the no off days part really makes it where you kind of almost have to play like the backup. They were always going to have Barnes catch, I would imagine, the Kershaw starts anyway, or at least once every like three or four games, you know. So like, this isn't that surprising, but like to get Smith's bat in there, as long as he's not like tiring, that would be great, because that was part of the problem last year. He was sort of run down at the end of the year and like slumped in September and October. So like, if they could just keep him, as long as he's like healthy and like productive, like, sure, get his bat in there, because that's one of the better, like, hitters they have.
All right. Trivia?
Yep. So we had a major league debut this week.
We did.
Zach McKinstry. First of all, he had a great quote. He was called up earlier this year for a day. It was the last day of the road trip, also in San Diego. But it was more for coverage, and he ended up not playing that game. And he got sent back, and then he's been on the taxi squad for I think almost every road trip. I think maybe one he didn't go on. So he's been around, right? Like he's been around the club, the clubhouse, the dugout, just around the team most of the year, at least, or like half the year, I would say. And I asked him, like, did that make it easier for major league debut? Because he finally made it on Wednesday. But he was like, no. He compared it to an amusement park ride. He's like, imagine you're waiting in line and you're like the third or fourth person back, and you're about to go on your ride, and then they shut the ride down.
And then
you have to wait 3 or 4 weeks or a month, and then you can't go on your ride anymore. And he said, like, that's how he compared it. He's like, it made me more nervous. I thought that was really funny. So, like, and also it reminded me of the time I went to Magic Mountain. I'm not a big roller coaster guy because I'm a big scaredy cat. But a friend of mine, Naveen, and I went on Colossus, I believe, 15 times in a row, because that, like, no one was going on Colossus. This was like 1994-ish. So like they had like probably the Batman ride and some other cool rides and stuff, but nobody was going on the big wooden roller coaster anymore. So like we went on the roller coaster, we'd get off, walk around to the line, and then it took like, you know, 3 minutes to get to the front of the line again. And then we just kept going on over and over and over again, and it was really fun. So I had the opposite of Zach McKinstry's experience in making his major league debut. But when he made his major league debut, he was the ninth Dodger that were or ninth player, excuse me, drafted by the Dodgers in 2016, drafted and signed by the Dodgers in 2016 to make the majors. That's tied for the most in any one draft by the Dodgers to make the majors. Can you name the other 2 years they had nine players?
We'll see after this. So I've had to strike a balance on these trivia questions because if I don't don't look into them at all before we go on air, it can create a lot of dead air while I think about things, and I might find some interesting things to talk about in doing research. But I also don't want to just look up the answers. So I think I found a good balance here in that I'm going to be blind guessing on one, and I have no idea what it is. I have a kind of guess on era, but I could be wrong. And I know the other one, but I did not know the year. I knew it was because we've talked about it on Dodgers Rewinds probably 8 times at this point, I think. And I knew it was the Garvey and Ron Say draft. So I hope I'm right. I was assuming, I guess. I know it's regarded as a very great draft, but I guess I don't know if it fits this specific criteria.
So is your guess 1968?
That is one of my guesses, yes.
That is not correct.
Man, so yeah, I guess I have nothing.
Okay, before...
And I want to know why. I want to know how this happens.
Okay, well, I can tell you this. So,
figured you could.
The draft rules were weird. There was like 3 drafts before. There's the June draft, which is the normal draft. That's the one they have now. There was a June secondary draft for a while and a January secondary draft. So like 68 is like the best draft year any team has ever had in terms of like just future production, right?
But so only the Dodgers, one particular draft produced.
I will tell you, in the June draft of 68, the Dodgers drafted and signed 6 players who made the majors. Bobby Valentine was first round. Their second round was Bill Buckner. Let's see, the other Joe Ferguson was 8th round. Doyle Alexander was 9th round. Bob Gallagher was 17th round. Tom Pashorek was 5th round. But if you go the big ones that year were from the other. I'm going to look them up. So June secondary that year, they also. They added a couple fellows named Ron Say and Steve Garvey, mm-hmm. and they also added Sandy Vance. So we are up to 9 there, but again, it's single draft. So in the January draft in 1968, let's just add this. They also – oops, that's the wrong one. See, even more, there's been the January and the January secondary draft, so it's always weird looking these up. But the January secondary draft that year, the Dodgers also added a fellow – named Davey Lopes, also Greg Zahn, or excuse me, Jeff Zahn, the pitcher. So that's 11. So obviously really good. Really good draft. Like 3/4 of the infield. Just great. But in terms of the
not single, answer this question. Draft, see, and this is why I look it up. I'm still going to be wrong, but I feel like a more educated Ron.
I will give you a hint, and it's a hint only for you for now, because the rest of the listeners don't know this yet, but our Dodgers Rewind was drafted in one of the answer years.
Okay, I'm can't scroll down the show notes. No, so so we're looking at like a late 80s or early 90s draft.
Pretty much.
90.
Okay, so I'll just give you the answer. So.
Is another one in the aughts? That's my other question.
Yes. That's the other thing you could sort of almost default to is the one of the 2 great Logan White drafts. So you had 2002 and then 2003. 2003 was one of the years that had 9.
I was going to guess it. My notes.
So the key players that year were Matt Kemp, Chad Billingsley, AJ Ellis, eventually. They also drafted Mark Mark Melanson, excuse me. But they didn't. they drafted him out of high school, but didn't sign him. So that,
no, it was
that would have been an interesting tenth.
Like interesting to look it up because the Wikipedia reviews of drafts are really good because they only pull out notable players. So it wasn't a way to cheat, but it kind of reminded me which one was which. Because in my I'm not mapping drafts to years so much as the Matt Kemp draft or the Andy LaRoche draft, if you will.
He was one of the players in 2003.
And so, for instance, in 2002, they list more Dodgers, but I still, even though that was the case, I was going to go with 2003.
Yeah,
had you let me.
Sorry.
Jerk.
But then also the other year, 1988, it was...
it's so often, it's the answer to everything. Damn it. I didn't want to go with it.
the two big names were like the... Eric Karras wasn't a first rounder, but sort of more towards the top of the draft. And then a certain 62nd rounder, Mike Piazza, was in that draft. So they drafted and signed 9 players that year that made the majors.
I have a trivia question for you before we move
on. Yes, yep.
Can you name, I'm trying to see... There's 6 players. No, I won't phrase it. I got it. In the 2004 draft, can you name the one notable player drafted by the Dodgers who did not sign?
In 2004?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's Hoshaver.
Nope.
Hoshaver.
That was an 03.
Oh, he was 05.
And
02,
I think. Yeah. 04 and 05. 04 and, or
O'Shaver
whatever.
Was 05 because of that. He went number one in 06. Because then that helped.
03 and 05, right? Because they drafted him twice. I remember this was
But like one of them was like a flyer. Like in 05 was like legitimately we're going to sign this guy because he was a high pick. And then so 04. Let's see. I'm trying to think.
Big
there
hint
was,
to give you.
Hold on.
If you need
04. So I want to say that was the Blake DeWitt year. And I can't remember which year was the Alex White year. But I don't know if he would warrant this kind of a trivia question. Oh, 04. Is Goldschmidt.
Nope.
David Price.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I was thinking, yeah. All right. Good.
02 was the other year they took a flyer on Hoshaver. Just to get that out there. All right. Dodgers rewind. 88
so,
draft.
Gary Ingram was, in fact, drafted by the Dodgers in 1988 in the 43rd round as a catcher. He did not sign, though, so he doesn't count as one of the 9. however, they drafted him again in 1989 in the 44th round. And he's like,
ooh.
You know what? I'm not going to pass this opportunity up again. I don't want to get this to go to the 45th
round. Yeah, that's just embarrassing.
So, but before Caber Ruiz earlier this year, when he homered in his first major league at bat, the last Dodger to do it was Gary Ingram in May 19th, 1994 at Coors Field. The Dodgers are currently playing at Coors Field. Also relevant. Now, what makes this weird is it's hard to search on Baseball Reference because you would like normally I think most cases for like a player making their major league debut or like hitting their home run in their first major league at bat, it's probably going to come in their first major league game. However, Gary Ingram was a pinch runner. I'm sorry. No, not pinch runner. He was defensive replacement in the 9th inning in his first game on May 15th that year. So if you look up like home run in first career game, that's how I would normally search for like this sort of a thing. So it doesn't always come up with that. So you just sort of have to know that he did and he did. But that was kind of like his most notable thing. So he's drafted as a catcher, never really played catcher. He never played catcher in the big leagues. He was mostly an infielder, started 24 times at second in his parts of 3 seasons with the Dodgers, had an 86 OPS plus, decent on base guy. He was 261, 340, 345. He hit 3 home runs in his first 22 games in 94 and then none in his last 60 games. So he only played with the Dodgers in the majors. I have sort of a no, this isn't really a trivia. I'm just going to state this. So in 1997, Gary Ingram was 4-for-9.
Wanted me to guess 4-for-9.
No, well, I looked this up because he also had a walk, I think. And so he had 10 plate appearances. So I looked up the best Dodgers batting average with 10 plate appearances. The best one is someone named Frank Scaff for Brooklyn in 1935. He was 6-for-11, 5-45. Previous old Dodgers rewinds, just last week, I believe, or 2 weeks ago, Cody Ross was 7-for-14 in 2006, and they DFA'd him. And Rafael Bornegal was 9-for-18 in 1993. He ended up taking over for another Dodgers rewind, Jose Offerman at shortstop in 94. And also, Jose Offerman was the last before Gary Ingram to hit a home run in his first major league at bat. So these are all very intertwined. Joe Thurston, back when the Dodgers didn't really have good prospects and he was their best prospect, he was 6-for-13 in 2002. Matt Hergis, who played for every team in the National League West, who was a pitcher, was 4-for-9 in 2001. And he also had another plate appearance, so he had 10. Now, none of those are related to this trivia question. However, I have another trivia question for you. Entering Friday, Max Muncy is hitting 194, 332, 389, but that's a 96 OPS plus. So what Dodger had the lowest batting average with enough plate appearances to qualify with a 100 OPS plus or better?
Do I get a hint at all?
I'll give you this hint to start.
Because I'm going to default to, like...
Well...
I don't know. Like, OPS plus. Like, that. Okay.
Yeah, no, so go ahead. I was like, if Muncy gets to 100 at a batting average close-ish to where he is now, he'll have the record.
Okay.
They hit over 200.
Is this a recent player?
It is.
Is it Jock Peterson?
It is.
Yes. Oh my God, I got a question right.
2015, he walked 92 times that year, so he actually had a 346 on base, but he hit 210, 26 home runs. The bulk of those were in the first half. That was a weird year.
I wanted to guess Adam Dunn, and then I'm like, okay, that doesn't work.
He's not a Dodger. Yeah.
I'm like, who's the Adam Dunniest Dodger?
So I searched this in like qualifying plate appearances, but then I was thinking, are there like weird season? Because like this season, even if you're qualifying, Muncy has like 215 plate appearances today. So like that's not that many. So I looked. I shortened it to like just minimum 200 plate appearances, and Jock still leads. Greg Brock is second. In 1983, he hit 224. That had to be he was like hated because he replaced Steve Garvey. But also, like, no one appreciated, like, OPS. No one knew what OPS was like that. But, like, he walked and hit enough homers to, like, you could argue he was more productive offensively than Steve Garvey for, like, a couple years. But he had the low batting. It just didn't look as good, right? So, like, that was a tough road to hoe for him. But when I lowered it to 200 plate appearances, he had another year, I think it was 85, that also qualified. I think it was either second or third. So, like, he was sort of the quintessential player. There's a bunch of like not that low batting average. Bob Carruthers, well, this is 1888, so he hit 230. That really shouldn't count. But Wes Parker hit 238 in 1965 and had 100 OPS plus. That was also the 60s, so it's weird. Yasmani Grandal in 2018 hit 241 with a 121 OPS plus. So there's some weird years, but not those aren't terribly low batting average. Jock at 210 certainly qualifies. So yeah, it's been a weird year for a lot of the Dodger lefties. Corey Seager's been like MVP level, but the other three like main lefties have been off. But yet they still have the major best record in the majors. So it's been a weird year.
Not weird at all. Will be us answering these
with Gene and Craig. We love them.
That was a professional lead-in.
It was. You're getting really good at that. I mean, you're not getting really good at it. You're just good at that.
Naturally. Like
you're the king of the segues, Jacob Birch.
Question A. As of this writing, there are four potential regular season milestones the Dodgers can reach in the next 9 games. How many should be celebrated professional by the team and their fans? Clinching playing at Dodger Stadium for the wild card, a.k.a. first round of the playoffs.
So they've basically already done that. They just have to be in the top 4 seeds, right? So, like, I'm just glancing at the standings right now. So they're – at worst, they would lose the division and then – compete with the other second place teams. So right now, in fact, yeah. So Miami entering today, 25-24, and the Dodgers already have 36 wins. So I think at worst, the Dodgers are the fourth seed. So they've already accomplished that. But in terms of celebrating, no, that's just a thing. So like it's like ancillary. So yeah, go on.
Clinching eighth straight NL West title. Yes.
So that's the one. Like that's the main one. Now, what was weird a week or so ago, I was sort of digging into this, and Roberts was like, "We want to celebrate every step of the way." Justin Turner said the same stuff, and like you know, every chance they get, and I'm on that train too. Like team celebrate, like always celebrate. Like anyone who's like, "Oh, well, it's not the big ring; they're wasting all this energy." Like, no, it's all about you. Everything is all these things are very difficult to do. You never know exactly how far you're going to go, so celebrate when you can and just enjoy it. But that said, when they clinched a playoff spot on Wednesday in San Diego, like almost nobody knew. Like they like found out like in the dugout of their clubhouse, and they're like, "Oh, all right, we're in." Okay, oh, okay. So like, also Major League Baseball this year, they're like banning alcohol from the celebration. So they're not going to have the wild celebration. They want to do like on field stuff, I guess. But they're going to celebrate pretty big, I think, when they win the division. But in terms of like,
break out the Marinellis,
but yeah, exactly. but yeah, they didn't. So they said they were going to like celebrate making the playoffs, but like they barely knew about it. So it's like, yay, we made it. That's been it.
The next is clinching the best record in the National League.
So they're going to basically do that roughly the same time they win the division. But that's not, they're not going to like do anything for that. That'll just be like a cool. We did that. Yeah. Like, yeah. So that's not a like jumping for joy stuff.
Clinching the best record in the majors.
No, cause that doesn't do anything. Like everything's at a neutral site. So like, I mean, technically I guess you get to bat last if you're in the World Series. So in, you know, games 1, 2, 6, 7. So like there is some advantage, but like that's not something you're like, you know, that they're not going to, that's not a celebratory thing.
It would be, we talked about this. It would be more celebratory for my heart if the extra innings rule was still in place, but it's not. So
oh, there you go.
Batting first with that is just, ugh. As noted before, Jacob and Eric, you're in parentheses though, yep, are fans of The Simpsons. Now, that show may not be something Jacob watches with his new child. It is anytime soon. It already has been. So so of these perhaps more suitable shows, what do you think would be fun to watch for Jacob's family? SpongeBob SquarePants.
So I don't really watch this. I have, like, the stuff I've seen of it has been pretty great. And it's more like, I think it just sort of passed me by. But there was a time in like the early, in like 2001-ish, I was living with my brother for a while and he had younger kids. And I like sat down and watched SpongeBob with them a few times. And it was hilarious. And I was like, this is great. And I enjoy the memes now. There's so many SpongeBob memes. So
popular with the kids.
I'm down with SpongeBob. It's just not something I really watch. But for sure, like that's something to watch. That's great.
I have seen a few episodes. I remember my brother watched it a lot, and he was of that age where he was too old for it, but like it was kind of cool to like it in that kind of weird way. So I would watch it now and then when he had it on. I have nothing against it, so it probably will happen. Yep. Mm-hmm. Any version of the Muppets show, sure.
Yeah. That's classic stuff. I would appreciate it if your child would end up with a sense of humor like Statler and Waldorf, that would be wonderful. That'd be good. I love it.
Any penis related cartoon show? I never got into like the series, the sort of, I don't know how many episodes there were, but the specials are mandatory. I think.
The specials are like staples, right? Like, depending on the time of the year, there's one for quite a few seasons. So seasons of the year, not, I don't really recall their watching like a peanut series so much as the annual specials or you know the ones they just show annually. But back I forgot back to the Muppets. I think Muppet Babies Count. Oh, I did watch that growing up, and like I don't know if that's it's probably on Netflix or something, but that was always fun too.
Tying those two together, a Muppet Christmas Carol is literally an annual watching for Melissa. So I'll be joined there, and I'm sure Ellie will follow along.
I know I've seen that, but it's been a long time, so I think I have to bust it out this year. That's pretty good.
Yeah, probably all of these still a ways away before she can comprehend TV. And then from what I understand from my other young parent friends, Daniel Tiger is what will invade my life shortly thereafter. So
okay.
Nice. Yep.
What about Peppa Pig?
That has come up, but we'll see. I've been told Daniel Tiger good and avoid Caillou. Those are the two things I've been told.
My cousin, his two daughters, they watched a lot of Peppa Pig. They might still do.
They might still do. I like that.
I say that because I haven't exactly like been over there because, you know, we're in a pandemic and haven't really been visiting folks a ton. But I assume they still watch it. But like, you never know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's sort of fun. I it's not the worst.
Question number C. Today is the 14th anniversary of one of the best games I ever saw in person, the 4+1 game. Now, since I was at the game and technology being what it was, I did not read Dodger Thoughts until I got home and Twitter had just launched in July 2006. I have a really good note on that. So that was not really placed in Gidget. What are your memories of that night? Were you watching Alon or something else?
I was trying to think. So in 06... I would imagine I had a Palm Trio at one point, like through work. And I believe you would have had to have that level of phone to even like load Dodger Thoughts, which is, you know, how we would have sort of followed along back then. But yeah, I was home. I lived in San Diego at the time. So I had the Padres broadcast. So I didn't get the Vin Scully call till later. I have sort of, it's sort of funny. Like I was watching I had one bedroom apartment. I was watching on the couch in the living room. And then the Padres scored like three runs in the top of the ninth against Takashi Saito to make it 9-5. Fun anecdote there. He went exactly one calendar year before allowing more than one run in a game again. And when he did it the next year, it was a Todd Helton walk-off when the Rockies, it was Rocktober, and they won like 22 out of 23 or something to get to the World Series. But back to 06, so it's 9-5. So I believe I angrily turned the TV off. I went in the other room, and because we haven't had an explicit tag in a while, I went to take a shit. And so
there are non-explicit ways to say that.
I guess, but it's more fun. But anyway, so I'm just sitting there and I don't think I was like mad at the game. They were in the pennant race or division race, so like it was thing. But like I think I was just like, well, what a dumb game. Like they should have won. And then at some point when I was done with my business, I got a text from a friend I worked with, and he's like, are you effing kidding me? I can't believe I just edited that out after I said that. But anyway, I was like, what? He's like, turn the game on. I turned it on just in time for as Marlon Anderson was batting. So I saw the fourth home run. And then I watched the rest of the game, obviously. But like, it was like, oh, okay, cool. Like that's weird. But yeah, that was my 4+1 story.
I can't remember what I saw live. That would have been really shortly after I started my first quarter at UCLA, which was and like moved out with my girlfriend at the time. Like it was an extremely busy time, so I was definitely not watching the game live. Was paying attention. I can't I definitely didn't see the four home runs. I know that, and I'm sad about that. And I can't remember how I stayed up to the date with the Dodgers at the time was the live journal community. I recall.
Oh, heck yeah.
And I remember seeing a picture of the scoreboard. And that's what made me either go watch the No More Homer live and like the 10th inning or just start watching highlights and videos. It must have been just highlights and videos because I think I would have been more excited, but it is definitely a blurry time. My note on the Dodger thoughts on reading it on your phone is I wrote a script, a little like silly PHP script, I think, that scraped Baseball Toaster's comments and reformatted them for a iPhone friendly format.
Wow.
Obviously not in for this game because the iPhone wasn't out yet, but for in 08 and 09. So I could actually read those. Maybe reply, maybe not reply, but at least read the comments very easily because I remember the Toaster site was not super iPhone friendly at the time. So,
I mean, well, and like there wasn't, that was like a new thing. Like who would make something to be a phone friendly? What are you talking about? It's on a computer, idiot. Like, yeah.
I don't, question D, I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that despite the Dodgers returning all of their key position players, without Mookie Betts, this team would not be in the position to do all they can to win a World Series this year. Jacob and Eric, if you had to rank Betts' five tools, put them in order of what has pressed you the most.
Okay.
Hammer.
Wrench. No, okay. We're going to do a draft of tools. Auger. No. So, you know, I want to say I think fielding is first for me. Only because it's like the most visually impressive. Or like soothing is probably the best word. Like
fielding, it's interesting because I'm almost the opposite, but not as a judgment of what they actually are, just in that I've always found outfield fielding outside of like the spectacular diving catches, which don't always happen and aren't always indicative of actually a good fielding tool, translate the least to TV. Like sometimes that the camera doesn't pan over in time until you see what could look like kind of, oh, that's an easy catch. But a great fielder breaks to it super quick and stuff like that.
But I think that's part of it. Like it's that every time the camera eventually pans to right field, Mookie Betts is almost always like, and it's like gliding there. He's not like at the end of a long run.
That's almost what I was going to say is like, and that's, this is a big reason why, you know, errors are poo-pooed, and we talked about this a little bit last week, is that he makes it look effortless. So effortless.
Yeah.
Like, doesn't look like he's doing this great, impressive thing. But like you said, when you really think about it, and especially if you can, the more of it you see, especially on replays, the more obvious it is of just how good it is.
Yeah, so I would probably, so that's for me. I can remember, like, maybe he's probably made I'm not going to say he's, like, perfect. I think he's made a couple, like, misplays I can remember. But, like, that'll happen, right? Like, that's just a thing that happens. But just generally, like, he seems very smooth out there. Now, it was a close call for me because I think running is second for me in that he's just – he seems to – like, his instincts are wonderful. And he's always, like, ready to take an extra base if necessary. He stole three bases the other day. It wasn't like two in one inning or anything. It was three different times. I think three different pitchers, just sort of a weird thing. And then just in like, I believe opening day, he scored the go ahead run on like a ground. It was an infield ground ball when he was at third, where he just sort of broke for home. That's like an exciting play. And it's just stuff like that. He makes things look exciting. And that's most evident when he's running. I don't know if like hit tool and hitting for power, like Craig mentioned, that they're obviously two different tools. I guess the power is because he's hitting so many home runs. I believe we could say this without breaking Major League rule. Yeah, he has 16 home runs now. He started the day with 15. So like that's a lot. and like I don't like even like he hit 32, I think, in his MVP year in 18. So like that to me seemed like the peak of his like home run hitting power. He'll hit a lot of doubles all the time. But, like, the fact that he has, like, 16 in – this is their 52nd game. So that's like it's a 48 to 50 home run pace. Obviously, pace doesn't equal doing it, but the fact that that is there in a such a relatively small body is kind of amazing. So that's probably third, and I guess hitting is probably fourth. I guess is next in line. I don't know if hitting in with runners in scoring position is necessarily a skill. It's just more reflective of what you do. But, you know, he's a guy where I think he's hitting like 450 or something with runners in scoring position this year. Obviously, small sample size. That's been really good. He had the one amazing throw in Arizona, but just generally, he had a throw yesterday where I think it was on a sac fly. He didn't get the runner at home, but he threw it to – it was like a cut-offable throw and thrown such a way where the runner at first could not advance to second. So it's always seems like he's always making the right play to make sure like that has the maximum advantage. And like that's like the total package, I think maybe all of it is most impressive. But if I had to rank him, that's sort of the order I would say.
Yeah, I think, like you said, it's the whole package. Ranking it is sort of silly. I was going to go with hit tool first, mm-hmm. only taking kind of a liberal definition of it in that I'm including approach, I'm including, you know, the ability to take a walk in that since it doesn't really fit anywhere else. And I'm including, yeah, just the sort of situality? the ability, like hitting a runner in his scoring position, doing so from a leadoff hitter, and just generally just how he looks, which is, you know, it's everything we've heard, right? And then maybe more so, especially in the power so far this year, is just like how much of a total package it is and how effortless he makes it all look. While we all know, hopefully, that it's not effortless and he's working extremely hard. But because he puts in on that work, it becomes across so polished. 12 more years.
it's just kind of amazing, to be honest. Yeah, it's weird.
Final question.
One of the actual redeeming qualities of 2020.
What was your go-to snack to buy at your grammar, middle school, or high school snack bar? We had apple machines, but my favorite was the Swiss cookies. We also had those big sweet rolls, and that was a special treat at recess.
That made me think of honey buns, and I don't remember those always being available at school. That we certainly had either, I think, like vending machine type thing in junior high, and then there was like a little snack bar in high school to get stuff. My favorite of all of those was a glazed sugar cookie that they made at the snack bar in high school, and we actually had like I believe we had a like snack period or like it was like a snack break.
Yeah.
It was probably in between like second and third period, if I remember correctly, where it was like a little bit longer. And we would always go. And so it was like I think it was $1.25 for the cookie. And it was a great cookie. It was just like a standard sugar cookie with like icing on it. But like it was awesome and it was just great. But the my favorite part was the lady who worked. It was like the nicest old lady, just the friendliest person you could imagine. And no matter what your total was, she would always say dollar bill afterwards. So she'd be like, "Oh, that's $1.25 bill today," and then she'd take your money or whatever. And just a delightful lady. And that's my memories of that. So that's probably my go to.
I ate like so much garbage in high school.
Oh, no question. And junior high too. Like I remember we had. I know we had Coke vending machines around, and at some point, I don't remember which year, it may have been multiple years in junior high, we would do races where we would see who could chug Coke the fastest. And sometimes it was chugging whatever you had like on hand. So like if you get a Gatorade, like a canned Gatorade or like, you know, whatever they had or whatever. But I was really good at that. So that was like a thing. So I guess that counts probably too. But yeah, just absolute garbage eaters, just for a solid portion there in like junior high and high school.
So my regular lunch was extreme hot Doritos, Shock nice. Tarts, and a Code Red Mountain Dew, to give you an idea.
Wow.
Like, just hitting all the food groups there. Good Lord. My favorite answer, though, it was a really rare thing in elementary school. They had a snack cart, and they had these Taz-themed chocolate. They called them milkshakes, but they weren't. It was basically chocolate milk, but I don't know if it was sweeter or creamier or what they did to make it just closer to a milkshake than doing chocolate milk, even if it wasn't a shake. And on really cold days, and they had them in the snack cart like a dozen times, and on a really cold day it actually would like pseudo freeze and almost become a milkshake, and those were special treats. So I'll go with that.
This is completely, almost completely off topic, but just this, for some reason, this reminded me of that. I was thinking, so at some point in elementary school lunch, we were all in like the cafeteria room or whatever, and you'd go through and you'd get your lunch. And they used to have, I believe, I remember going back up to the line, and if they had like extra, like either milk or orange juice or something, like we would ask if they had any extra, they would like give you some for free. And I always like, even if I didn't want, it was like, it just felt good getting something free. But that sort of like reared its head again in freshman year of high school. Campus was closed to for freshmen, but we snuck off a lot and walked because it was close to Straw Hat Pizza. Which was just down the street, and they had a deal where they'd make these little mini pizzas, like the size of a paper plate. It was that a cheese mini pizza and a Coke was $1.25, and a pepperoni pizza and a Coke was $1.50. So it's like the greatest deal that you can imagine. They were just cranking those things out. So the best part was, you know, you'd go and spend like, you know, $3 and have like, you know, a king's ransom for lunch, and then at the end, near the end of lunch period, you'd go back up to the counter and be like, "Hey, do you have any extras?" And they're like, "Here, have this one," because they made too many. So always trying to get free food. That was sort of the goal, and I love it all.
I'm gonna go have some free food. It's free because it's in my fridge.
I'm gonna go buy a honey bun now that Craig reminded me of these wonderful terrible snacks. So go eat something with sugar in it, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.